we'll just have a little Dhamma talk for a while about the subject of Buddha's teaching. But Caroline gave me this book called The Buddha Smiles, and she said this is the humorous sections of the suttas when the Buddha was being humorous. But she said, oh, it's not as good as Phyllis Diller. Phyllis Diller pretty good. She said, oh, I hate getting old. When I look down at the dashboard, I can't tell if it's half past noon or if I'm driving 120 miles an hour. She said, I hate housework. I wash the dishes, I make the bed, I sweep the floor, and I have to do it all over again next month. She's funny, but this is probably pretty funny. See this. Steve, who's not here tonight, asked me if I would give a talk about social activism and the balance of like a meditation and activism, or how to keep our spiritual life and our social activist life in balance and harmony. And so that's what I'll talk about from my experience. Maybe I'm right, maybe I'm wrong. Just take whatever I say with a grain of salt. If it's useful, apply it. If it's not, I'm not the authority of anything, you know. I'm not sure. You might have better ideas, but just from practicing Buddhism and mostly I'm going to be talking about what I learned from Mahagosananda, my teacher, advice and his example and his advice on, because he was a peace activist. He was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize, actually, for the work he did in Cambodia to help bring peace to Cambodia after the Khmer Rouge period. So I'll just kind of pass on some of the things that he taught me, and you know, his point of view or his philosophy or his way of life. So maybe I'll just begin reciting one of his teachings and then just kind of comment on it, use it as a base for kind of commentary. He said, we want peace in the world, but there's little that we can do for peace in the world without peace in our own mind. So to make peace, we begin with silence, meditation, and prayer. Peacemaking requires compassion. Compassion requires listening. To listen, we must give up our own selves, even our own words. We listen until we can hear our own peaceful silence, our own peaceful nature. When we learn to listen to ourselves, we learn to listen to others as well, and new ideas grow. Down at that ground of the heart, the silent heart. When we get down to the ground, new ideas grow. There is an openness and a harmony. We see new possibilities, new visions. When we begin to trust one another, we see new possibilities for resolving conflict. Peacemaking requires mindfulness, he said. There can be no peace with jealousy, resentment, and meaningless criticism. To make peace, we must make a decision that making peace is more important than making war. It's a choice. We have to choose and then do it. Peacemaking requires selflessness. It is selflessness taking root. To make peace, the skills of teamwork and cooperation are essential. The true peacemaker will work only for peace, not for fame, glory, or honor. If we work for fame, glory, and honor, we will only harm our efforts. Peacemaking requires wisdom. Peace is the middle path of equanimity, non-duality, and non-attachment. It is the perfect balance of wisdom and compassion, the perfect meeting of humanitarian needs with political realities. Loving kindness is the only way to peace. Okay, so these are some of his teachings. When I was a young person, and most of my life I've been kind of an activist when I was young, a very much activist, like a radical, you know, young people, radical. You know, Mark Twain said, young people who are conservative have no heart, and old people who are liberal have no head. Right? So I was a young person with a lot of heart, very radical. You know, I hated the injustice in the world and all of the unfairness, you know, all the suffering, the poverty and racism and all of the, you know, this. Things, I wanted the world to be right, and so I was very active in a lot of projects, advocating for people with AIDS, and, you know, in the 80s when I was a kid, young. And I was overwhelmed by the anger and the suffering, you know, the grief, seeing the world like this, you know, all the troubles we see. It's very hard on young people to see the war, poverty, all this crazy stuff, and it seems even worse now than it was, you know, when I was a kid. Now the wars have multiplied, the environment and all of these things, the problems seem to even be bigger. And it's scary, it's very easy to be overwhelmed and in despair even, you know, about the suffering, and that's why people become terrorists, you know. They're overwhelmed with grief and rage, consumed by it. So there's a lot of suffering in the world, and so it was political, you know. I thought, okay, political change, we need a revolution. We need to elect a new leader. We need to change the laws. We need to change the institutions. And I found out, you know, you elect a new leader, nothing changes. You change the institution, nothing changes. You change the laws, nothing really changes. And I was very frustrated and angry by that, you know, because I didn't, you know, I thought things should change, you know. And it was about that time I was really angry. I mean, really angry to the point, you know, of really not even wanting to live anymore in a world like this. And it just happened. I started practicing meditation to try to find a way to release that anger, so find some inner peace, some, you know. And to my surprise, it worked. It really had a profound effect on me. And it was that time when I began exploring meditation and Buddhism that I happened to meet Mahakosananda from Cambodia. That was in the 80s, or around 90, 91, 92, when many of the refugees were fleeing from Cambodia and they were coming to America. And Seattle is one of the main cities, the third largest Cambodian community. And so I met Mahakosananda visiting the Cambodian temple and, you know, just listening to him, and he got my attention because I heard, oh, you know, he lived through war. He had faced a genocide. He had faced civil war, the Vietnam War, the Khmer Rouge, but he was happy. He He was so happy and so radiant, so full of joy, so peaceful. And so I became interested, you know, I was like, this is a person who has faced the worst that can happen. He's faced hell. He's faced his demon, despair, everything, you know, the worst that can possibly happen. He's faced it and he passed through it. He showed me or told me, you can turn suffering into happiness. You can turn hell into heaven if you have enough wisdom, enough compassion, enough heart. You know, it's the changes in the world, electing a new leader, electing a new party, changing the institution, passing a law. These changes are just rearranging the furniture on the deck of the sinking ship. The change we need is deeper than institutional change or structural change. We need a change of heart. We need a change of consciousness. We have to change the way we live in the world. It beginning with me, beginning with the individual. It's personal. Everything is personal. It's not institutional. The changes are not out there. The changes are here. And when we change ourselves, we change the world. He said, when you can walk down the street with peace in your heart, then there's peace in the world. That's the only way to make peace. You can't make peace out there. Make it in here. And when you change, the world begins to change. The suffering in the world is like a mirror of the suffering in people's hearts. We inflict it in the world. The war, the hatred, the greed, this is a mirror or reflection of the suffering in human consciousness, in human hearts. When we heal ourselves, the world will heal itself. The suffering disappears. Because when we are suffering, we inflict it into the world. We project it into the world. It's a reflection of our greed, our hatred, and our ignorance. This is the Buddha's teaching. Inner peace is a transformative power in the world. It changes the world. These are the teachings that he was talking about. It begins with inner transformation. So that was why he said peace begins with silence, meditation, prayer. And then how do you do that? That second part, he was like, you have to give up yourself. He has deep meaning. You have to give up your ego, yourself. And how do you do that? You have to listen to your own heart. Listen deeper than these opinions and these judgments in your head, these views in your head. Now, you listen until you hear the silence beneath the words, the ground of your being, the ground of your heart. You get down to the ground of your heart. And he said, there's an openness and a harmony. You begin to see the common humanity. When you hear your silence, so when you hear your silence, you learn to listen to yourself. You learn to listen to others because you can hear their silence, their heart, too. You experience our common humanity. And when you get down to that level that you really see this, you begin to change. He said, you have new vision, vipassana, insight. You have a new insight, new possibilities. See, your fear sees enemies and conflict. Your loving kindness sees friends. When you listen deep enough to hear the common humanity of the other, you can hear their heart, not their words. You know, you can hear their heart, their fear, their anger, their hurt. And when you speak to that, not to the words, but to their heart. Calm their fear, calm their anger, when they know that you've heard them, then that begins to disappear. And they can begin to trust you because they know you're listening. They've been heard. And so we can find new possibilities to resolve the problem, whatever it would be, the conflict. So that's what he's talking about. I'm 60, and I've been, you know, around for a while now, a few decades, doing activism, and so you get some perspective after that, you know, and the world doesn't change easily. The world doesn't change quickly. Because the problems we're facing, like, are generational. You know, they're bigger than even our generation. The materialism, the consumer culture that we are stuck in is going to last for a while. It won't last forever, but we have to live in the conditions that we are finding ourselves in. So we have to endure or abide. We can't burn out. This is a long haul, you know. We have to have a long haul vision. I call it the 10,000-year plan for peace and justice throughout the universe. It's a long project. But we have to find peace, you know. One of the images I like to, a historical period that kind of inspires me when I feel frustrated or sad by the things that are going on in the world. But I lived in Cambodia, and I had a chance to explore and study the history of the Angkor, Cambodia, Angkor Wat, and the Angkor Empire. And you know, some of you have been to Asia maybe and visited Angkor and seen these wonderful, amazing stone temples. There are over 200 of them in Cambodia. Angkor Wat is just the biggest one and most famous, and it's over a mile. It's probably the largest temple in the world, I think, because it's like a mile around to walk around the temple. And it's a huge, massive, you know, huge stones that they carried. And the Angkor Empire was huge. It was a Hindu empire. And basically it was a slave society. All of those temples were built by slaves. Hundreds of thousands of people died building those for the king, who would have been a god to them, you know. This temple was a temple that the people couldn't even go into. It was a slave society. The people lived and died just for the benefit of the king and the few royal people around him, you know, few hundred or a few thousand people that really benefited from all this. It was very cruel life, short, a lot of suffering. And they had no rights, you know, it was a slavery, a slave society. And they could, you know, they had no even right to life. The king killed them for no reason, you know. He thought they were disrespectful or anything. It was a bad situation. And the people who built those temples couldn't even go into them. It was only for the Brahmin, the priests, and the king. It was his temple. And he was the god of the temple. But Buddhism was there under the surface. Theravada Buddhist monks were living there as hermits in the forest, practicing meditation, teaching these teachings of the Buddha, compassion for all living things. You know, basically human rights. I mean, because the Buddha's teaching is that every human being is potential Buddha. Every person has the potential for attainment, enlightenment. You don't have to be a Brahmin or a king or a god to become a sacred person. Every person has Buddha nature. This is what those monks sitting there quiet in the jungles were teaching the slaves, the peasant, the farmers, and the people were building those temples. They would practice meditation and study in the forest, you know, this Buddhist teaching. The little boys, the little girls would come to the temple. The people would give the monks a handful of rice to eat every day. And they lived close to the people. They were not high, far away. You know, they lived close to the people. And these ideas of the Buddha germinated in this society for, you know, hundreds of years. It was a paradigm shift that took a long time. But this is how they changed their mind. They changed their heart. It wasn't a revolution. You know, they lived together quietly, teaching peace, the ways of peace, teaching human dignity, teaching love and compassion, teaching enlightenment, how to find inner peace. And, you know, the boys could come and live in the temple. The old people could come and live with the monks, practice meditation. And over generations, over centuries, these ideas percolated and permeated through the society until after 1,000 years, you know, I think it was the 13th century, the society just became Buddhist. There was no war, there was no struggle. They were really changed. They had a transformation of consciousness. They became Buddhists. They overcame slavery. They overcame suffering, poverty, and war without conflict, because they transformed consciousness through loving kindness and through generosity, through compassion, through meditation. This is what Mahagosananda was talking about. It begins when personally, you know. One time when I was in Cambodia, a peace activist from European peace activist came to him and said, "What can we do for world peace?" And Mahagosananda said, "You just take care of yourself. When you take care of yourself, you're taking care of the whole world." And I thought, what? You know, he didn't tell him, you know, go join the organization or start a movement or something. He said, take care of yourself. When you take care of yourself, you're taking care of the whole world. And I would think about that a lot and try to understand what was he talking about. And that's what he was talking about. When you are happy, you become a source of happiness for others. You become a source of peace for others. When you're suffering, you make other people suffer. You become a source of suffering for others, and you project that into the world and create conflict. When you're happiness, you become a source of happiness, a presence of happiness in the world. And you begin to transform the world through personal presence. You transform your relationships with your family, with your community, with your country, the whole world. It has to begin like that. We can't make peace out there, you know. There are so many angry peacemakers. They want people to be peaceful. They want the problems to stop, you know, and they're everywhere, you know, angry. But the first duty of a peacemaker is to be peaceful. This is what Mahatma Gandhi was talking about. He says you have to be the change you want to see in the world. When you become peace, there's peace in the world. When you become peaceful, you are a peaceful presence. You transform the whole environment, the whole situation. So, one more thought about this is, there was a wonderful American example of this. Her name was Peace Pilgrim. Read about her and her life and her teachings. She was wonderful. She was like Mahagosananda. She had the same thing. You just do it yourself. Don't wait for other people. Do it. Take out walking. Be peaceful. And you spread peace wherever you go. And her teaching, she said three things. First, fellowship. Then, consciousness raising or education. And then, activating. So, first, fellowship. Sangha. Community. You're not alone. You don't have to do it on your own. American society is so individualistic. So we think we have to do it ourselves. And that is very, you burn out. You are overwhelmed because you can't do it by yourself. It is scary to do it by yourself. You know, to think you have to face the world alone. So the first, it's important to have, to come together with fellowship. With the Sangha, community, building community with others who understand, who are practicing the enlightened teachings of the Buddha, of Buddhism, you know, who practice wisdom and compassion. And as we do that, fear disappears, trust grows, because this is a sense of belonging. Fear comes from the feeling I have to watch out, I have to help myself, I have to protect myself. And it creates conflict. Conflict arises out of that fear. The more we build connection, a sense of belonging, a sense of care, being cared for and caring for others, the more the fear is relieved or dissipated or dissolved, and the more the sense of belonging or trust in life, trust in this world, grows. And so this becomes a source of energy. You know, if you're acting out of fear or anger, you'll burn out. You can't go very far. That's why so many peace activists do burn out, you know, or are destroyed, burn up, you know, compassion fatigue, something like that, you know. The woman who wrote The Rape of Nanking, you know, what was her name? Iris Chang, I think it was her name. And she was a very kind and compassionate person, very overwhelmed by the suffering of the Chinese people in Nanking during that invasion. And a few years ago, during the Guantanamo Bay, and she was trying to write a second book about torture, American torture going on. And she was just she committed suicide, you know. She was just so overwhelmed by the suffering of the world. She just couldn't take it anymore. This is what happens to us when we feel we have to do it alone. This is why it's important to have this Sangha, this sense of community, belonging. Because we grow in strength. We don't burn out. We grow because we're doing something happiness. We're doing something beneficial in the world. So we grow in happiness as we, the more active we become, the more strength we have we have shifted our center of gravity from fear or anger to love and compassion. So the more we do, the happier we grow. We don't burn out. We grow in strength as we move forward. So community, very important. Then she said educate. Raise awareness of what we're doing about, you know, the economy, the environment, education, you know, the things that we see where the problems are. In our own community, in our own world, where we can act, you know. And then we began to act in what is in front of us. We don't have to go somewhere else. There are plenty of things right in front of your eyes, your ears, your nose, your tongue, your body, and your mind. You can respond to. As you respond to them, you discover the path of action, you know. It's not ideal. It's real. It's personal. You know, it's not acting out of some utopian idealism that this is the way that things should be. It's acting for persons and what is personal. You know, especially educated people and Western people, we live in our head so much, and we have so much theory of how things should be, and analysis of why they're wrong, you know, and we're stuck in our heads, and we have a lot of idealism or a lot of utopian ideas, you know. And when we try to project our utopian ideas onto reality, we actually make things worse, I think. Because our ideas are not reality. You know, people don't fit into, people are not ideal. So we try to make the world fit into our idealism. And we harm people, we run over people in the process. We mistake means and ends. You know, we end up doing harmful things for good ends. But when we act for people, we get it straight. We do something good. We do good means that result in good ends. So I would like to read one little quote that I find very inspiring, if I can find, from someone who inspires me a lot, Thomas Merton. But he was writing to a peace activist who were asking some of the same questions, you know, because it was during the Vietnam War when he wrote this, and they were frustrated also and angry and overwhelmed and sad and things like that about the trouble in the world. And he said, you know, he gave this encouragement. He said, do not depend on the results, on the hope of results. When you are doing the sort of work that you have taken on, essentially an apostolic work, you may have to face the fact that your work will apparently be worthless and even achieve no result at all, if not even the opposite result of what you expected. That happens a lot. You know, we try to, our efforts very well may produce the opposite result of what we're expecting, you know, in the short term, because we're intensifying the causes and conditions. If we want to change the problem, we have to change the underlying causes and conditions. But when you push, you get pushback. So if you have to dissolve the underlying infrastructure, you know, instead of attacking the problem, attack the causes and conditions that cause the problem to appear. You know, the people who are fighting the death penalty, you know, they're doing something good, but you know, by look what happened, you know, they're attacking the people, the drug makers, and then out of their good efforts, something even more horrible happened, you know, the horrible ways that they're using different kind of drugs to kill the prisoners that are even more horrible than the ones that they can't get. So this is an example of what he's talking about. Sometimes our effort will even intensify the results. So we have to be careful what we're doing. As you get used to the idea, don't worry about the result. Worry about the causes and conditions. You take care of the causes and conditions. The causes and conditions will produce the result. As you get used to this idea, you start more and more to concentrate not on the results, but on the value, the rightness, the truth of the work itself. And there, too, a great deal has to be gone through, and gradually you struggle less and less for an idea or a cause, and more for people. See, we're getting at away from the idealism to the personal level, caring about people, real living beings, persons, personal action, you know. The range tends to narrow down, but it gets much more real. In the end, it is the reality of the personal relationship that saves everything. You are fed up with words, and I don't blame you. I am nauseated by them sometimes. I am also, to tell the truth, nauseated by ideals and causes and movements. This sounds like heresy, but I think you will understand what I mean. It is so easy to get engrossed with these ideas and slogans and myths that in the end, one is left holding the bag empty, with no trace of meaning left in it, in order to make a meaning be there again by some magic. Going through this kind of reaction helps you to guard against this. Okay, well. So he's saying, act for living things instead of for ideas. You know, the people who are ideals, they have great ideas, but they can do great evil. You know, that's like the communists began out that way. You know, they wanted a humane society of equality and everything, but then they destroyed people for their ideals. You know, it ended up creating more suffering in the world, making things worse. So acting for on the personal level. So in meditation practice or in our spiritual practice, this comes to enlightenment. Enlightenment is the goal of Buddha's teaching. Enlightenment is wisdom and compassion. You know, Mahakosananda said, peacemaking is wisdom and compassion. It has to be in balance. It is the meeting, you know, of humanitarian needs with political reality. It is compassion without concession, peace without appeasement. We have to find that balance. And so enlightenment is wisdom and compassion. Wisdom is an understanding mind. Compassion is an understanding heart. Wisdom and compassion are the same thing. Wisdom sees the oneness of all reality, the underlying oneness or harmony of being. Compassion sees the individual. It's the same thing. So they go together. Our meditation practice helps insight into the true nature of reality until we can see this oneness. All people, all living things are one. It's all connected. And then we can respond to the individual expression of this oneness, the individual manifestation of the oneness of life, this person, this animal, this forest, this living thing. We act to appreciate, to protect, to care for living things, for life. You know, it's not for an ideal. It's for a reality of life. So, does that make sense? You see what I'm talking about? This is how inner transformation can lead to outer peace. So I will stop there, and we have a few minutes. So anyone share some thoughts that might have come up, or some question, or some point of view?
Wonderful.
Yeah. To sometime.
She is a beautiful child. Mm-hmm. She is very understanding and mm-hmm. very well raised. By my open mind,
Demeter. We can.
Another outside source, another outside open mind mm-hmm. as yours to,
yeah.
to talk to her. This is my first time here.
Mm-hmm. Well, welcome.
You've said a lot of things that I've researched.
Oh, thank you.
I, it's not like I researched them as I was Googling on my phone now. I've understood a lot of things you said.
Oh, thank you so much.
I'd love
yeah.
for you to hear.
Yeah, we live in Woodinville, so it's kind of a... I come here sometime. Maybe we can meet next time before the group.
No worries, no worries.
And you can come visit Woodinville. We have Sunday school class, and we have children. Also, I teach meditation usually every Sunday for our children. We have about 40 or 50 kids, about 5 or 6, 7 years old, and children can practice meditation. You know, they learn. Their mind is very pure, and we teach them. I teach them loving kindness meditation. So I teach them how to first calm their mind, and then I teach them. Say, okay, now imagine a bird, and they're like, okay. I say, can you see a bird? And they're like, yes, I can see a bird. I say, okay, now, may the bird be happy. May the bird be peaceful. May the bird be free from suffering. May no one throw rocks at the bird. May, you know, and they meditate like this about fish. And it's helping them. You know, they're concentrating. They're paying attention. Purifying their mind, developing kindness, and then at the end I tell them to meditate about your grandmother. Can you see grandmother, grandfather? And think about how you feel when you're together with them. Make you feel good. And they're like, yeah. And think how much they love you.
I told my kid that I was going to push her down as soon as it snowed. She asked me why.
Yeah.
She loves it. She goes, okay, as soon as it snows, she'll push me down.
Yeah, children are great. Yeah. Easy to, they love to practice meditation. So, love kindness. Teach children generosity to feed the fish, feed the birds. Very good for their mind. So, thank you so much.
Yeah. She saw me fishing one time. And she goes, I don't want to eat fish anymore.
Yeah. She's very sensitive, you know. She's very sensitive. Don't kill the animal.
I had to explain to her that it was okay, but she, you know, for maybe almost a year, she didn't want to eat fish.
Yeah.
She's only 5.
She's smart.
She gave up fish for like a year.
That's very good.
From 3 to 4, she gave up fish.
Yeah, but she's very sensitive. Children. But she sounds like she might be an old soul, you know, more sensitive than most. If she did, she doesn't want to eat the fish, you know. Kids are very perceptive. Have a lot of natural wisdom.
Thanks.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I really appreciate that you came. Happy to see you. Thank you. I'll recite the teaching of loving kindness then as a blessing for our mind. These are the words of the Buddha, and this is how he taught how to practice loving kindness. He said, those who are skilled in the way, and the way of the Dhamma, the way of the Buddha, and who seek to attain the state of calm and peace of mind, should act this way. We should be able and upright, exceedingly upright, considerate, gentle and humble, contented, easily supported, of a simple lifestyle, with few obligations, courteous, discreet, controlled in the senses, not hankering after praise or recognition. Let us never do anything that the wise would reprove, but may our constant thought be, may all beings be happy. May all beings be happy, whatever they are, large, medium, or stout, short, small or tall, those that are near, those that are far away, those that are seen and those that are not seen, those that are born and those yet to be born. May all beings be happy. Let us never deceive another. Let us never despise any being in any place whatsoever. Let us never wish harm against another out of ill will or hatred. But just as a mother protects her only child at the risk of her own life, so in the same way, let us cultivate unlimited loving kindness for all living things. Let us cultivate unlimited loving kindness for the whole world, above and below and all around in every direction. Whether we are walking, standing, sitting, or lying down, as long as we are awake, let us continuously cherish the thought that this way of living is the best in the world. Not falling into false views, being virtuous, endowed with insight, having abandoned the attachment to the senses, we will no longer perpetuate endless cycles of suffering for ourselves or for others. Oh, excuse me.